How do you, in terms of just like operating restaurant, this is like aside from COVID, how do you balance that desire to serve the best quality ramen with the realities of cost and profit margins and things like that? Like,
yeah.
How do you, what things do you feel like just personally, like, okay, we can do this to stretch costs. Like you kind of mentioned the Nibon, you're doing Nibon, the pythons mm-hmm. and things like, or like, how do you balance that? You know, like, what are you doing to balance those two things? Cause it sounds like you have a strong desire to serve really kotowari, you know, mm-hmm. bowls,
right.
But you still have to run a business.
Like, how I don't know. It's, I would say it's my, my own slave labor. I'm here all day, every day. So maybe that's helping with the cost. Yeah. But you know, it's a passion project, you know, it's really just blood, sweat, and tears that go into this. You know, we're here every day, you know, holding it down. I think that's one of the main things. You got to have passionate chefs that really love what they're doing. I think that's one of the core things, you know, it goes beyond profit margins and things like that, for sure.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Way Ramen Podcast. On today's episode, I sit down with Alex Ryutaro Aramaki, who runs a shop in Vancouver, British Columbia called Gyopara. Alex is actually a third generation ramen chef, with his grandfather operating a ramen shop in post-war Japan in the 1950s. After he helped open up a few ramen franchises in the BC area, namely Jinya and Dambo, Alex brought back Gyopara, which was his dad's restaurant from the 90s, with the intent of making food again from scratch. In this episode, we get into Alex's family history with ramen, his work with opening up franchises and then eventually opening up his own shop, and also some of his tips to make better ramen at home. So without further ado, here's Alex Ryutaro Aramaki on the Way of Ramen Podcast. Enjoy. So thanks for coming on. I really do appreciate it. And it's kind of last minute and stuff, but
it's our pleasure.
And I know you're busy. You got your own restaurant and stuff to take care of. So it's it's a treat for me. So we could start off by just give us a short introduction on who you are, and then we'll kind of get into your whole family history after that. But just like really quickly, like who you are, where you're at, you know, your shop.
Sure. So my name is Alexander Ryutaro Aramaki. I was born in Canada, but I'm Japanese, and I'm a third generation ramen chef, and just continuing on the family tradition here. And I really love what I do. I just make ramen all day. And, you know, that's what I've been doing for professionally over 10 years, 12 years now, I guess. And yeah, I'm really happy to be here. I love your community. I love your content. So it's good to be here.
Awesome, man. Yeah, so we can get into that right away. You have like a really interesting story, which is why I kind of wanted to get you on the show. It's you're like the first multi-generational guest on the show. Like a lot of us... you know, we kind of pick it up. I'm really new to it still. Like I picked it up a couple of years ago, but your family has been in ramen for how long was it? 50 years, 60 years, you know, like 70 years, even 70 years, maybe. Could you tell us a little bit about your family's story in ramen?
Sure. Yeah. It's quite interesting. I took a few notes down here. But yeah, our ramen history goes back at least to the 50s.
1950s, right? Like
that's right.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So I can get into a little bit of the details here, but essentially my grandfather started his ramen career in 1950, post-war, everyone was hungry and he was in the yatai scene and, you know, it's cooking food for the people. And, but before that, his cousin and his uncle, used to have a ramen factory essentially, and that's how he got his got into the game. And it goes back a long
you can tell the whole story. I mean, like it's pretty interesting because like I kind of read a little bit about it, right? He had like a ramen shop first, okay, right? Yep. And then it transitioned into like this big kind of like I don't know exactly what it was, like a CPG or like a manufacturer, like some kind of like mass some kind of manufacturing company, right? Like it transformed from that into that. So can we talk about that? Like what the original shop was called?
The original shop was called Yoyoken, and that was actually 1954. But he also had his own noodle factory, like a small one, 1952. So, and then he used his own noodles for his own restaurant. And then that went really well. He was one of the biggest, he was kind of like setting the wave in Tokyo. And by 1966, he established Tsukimen Ramen Ya, which was based in Tsukishima. So it was abbreviated to Tsukimen. And Tsukimen was really successful. He was one of Japan's biggest entrepreneurs at the time. And yeah, it was, Tsukimen was up there with the other big corporations that still exist today, like Nissin, the cup noodle guys. And but yeah, the company that he established, which my dad was also a part of when he was young, they had like unlimited resources essentially when it came to the noodle production. And they really focused their efforts and they were trend setting. They were pretty much the first to have atmospheric control in the noodle factory, where they have air shower. They wear suits and then they shower them with air, you know, nice and clean. And then inside the actual facility, it's all atmospheric controlled, because you know, noodles, you know, they're very sensitive products. The moisture content in the atmosphere alone can change the percentages of everything. So they're really into that, and they're really into their craft.
And then he went on to like sell that business or something. Like what?
Right.
What happened?
Oh, yeah. So that's kind of a tragic event, but essentially the unions kind of revolted against the company, because what happened is the company got so big, it had three different locations. And the company was looking to kind of merge it into one new location, you know, just to save costs, because you can't move all that product around three locations.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the company was looking to kind of centralize, but there was some union issues, and essentially they ran the stories that like essentially that was not good. Like, essentially the unions didn't want to, you know, move, and if they move, the unions would lose their job. It was kind of dramatic. Essentially, yeah, they merged with Nissin Noodle Company, because Nissin at the time only did dried products, dry noodles, and Tsukimen had frozen raw noodles and like real noodles, frozen dumplings. And they were really fascinated. And then they essentially merged. And then Nissin started doing multiple product lines. And they still continue the Tsukimen Ramen Ya brand to this day.
Oh, wow.
So, pretty cool.
So you can still buy that in Japan and stuff?
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Name still lives on.
That's awesome. So how did you guys end up in Vancouver? Like, how does that happen?
So my dad is kind of like a dreamer. And I guess he went to UVic back in the day, back in the 70s, and you know,
so he's like studying abroad, like a Japanese guy coming to Canada to study abroad, want to learn English and stuff. Yeah. And
exactly. And he was like a hippie, you know, just really enjoying life. And then my grandfather forced him back to Japan to continue on the work, you know. And then as Tsukimen got merged, and he decided he wanted to, you know, continue on his life freely in Canada, where it's, you know, nice and beautiful, lots of nature. And he brought with him one of those industrial Tsukimen noodle machines to Canada. And he made the Canada Noodle Company in 1987.
It's like an almost identical story to Sun Noodle here in Hawaii. It's like a guy, I mean, not like the whole history of family in the business, but he came to Hawaii with like one noodle machine, and it's like,
I'm gonna make
noodles. Really similar. What kind of, by the way, just before I move on, like what kind of ramen was your grandpa serving? Was it like, cause it was like 50s in the
Tokyo. Yeah. Tokyo Shoyu, just like a generic, old school. Cause before in the '50s, you know, there was only chuka soba. Shoyu ramen. But, I can rant more about ramen history in general. I actually have a few notes I wanted to discuss.
I find it like, it's really interesting, because, you know, like I'm sure like a lot of people who listen to this podcast know a little bit about like how ramen actually is a relatively new food, and it really developed in that time period where your grandpa was on the boots on the ground, like making ramen and selling ramen and making noodles. So yeah, like if you want to share about that kind of stuff, that's really cool. Cause you guys, your family has that firsthand experience at look at what was happening at the time, like we read books and watch videos of like old footage of black and white photos. It's like, oh yeah, these people look like they're like it looks like in a post-war country serving noodles out of a little cart. But you got more insight into that.
Yeah. So yeah, for sure. The noodle boom, the ramen boom, essentially in the 50s, is very fascinating. But I also really enjoy the history before that. You know, kind of like the Chinese influence and the trade between Japan and China. So I was looking into that, and you know, Nagasaki in Japan has the world's oldest Chinatown, I believe, outside of China, because it was a trade port with China that was open, you know, since the 1500s. So
in Kyushu, right? Like that like Kyushu is kind of weird. Like even when they shut everything down, like people could still trade there for some reason. Like, so even like the Dutch and the Portuguese were still trading.
Right. Yeah. So yeah, my theory is that noodles with kintsugi, you know, ramen, could have been like really old in Japan, and we just never knew. And another interesting fact about, you know, kintsugi and, you know, the iconic ramen noodles is that I believe it's the Yunnan province in China. They had spring water that was had high potassium content, and then they used that to make their noodles, and they liked it. I think that's how kintsugi based noodles were born, essentially. So that's really fascinating.
Yeah, it's like just by accident, pretty much. They're trying to make noodles in that one pond or spring that they're taking out of.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, some crazy stuff, man.
Yeah, and like Nagasaki champon is really ancient, really, really old. I believe it was like a staff meal. Essentially, they just threw everything in the pot and then they served it with noodles, you know. So that's really fascinating. Yeah. And that's pretty much. I just wanted to discuss a little bit about the history there before, you know, the boom.
Yeah.
Pretty cool if you think about it. Yeah.
Yeah, because I mean, like, when I left, some of the Japanese chefs in Japan that I had on, they're like, when you always ask them, like, oh, what do you think about ramen outside of Japan? And they're like, it's a Chinese food in Japan. So it's like, you can't really, Japanese people can't tell people that's not ramen when ramen itself came from China, right? So it's like,
for sure.
Who are they to say? Yeah, that's what these people in Japan have told me anyway. So yeah, kind of totally. Always interesting to hear that, because in the West, at least in America, people are like, oh, ramen is Japanese food. But Japanese people, you get it at what is that called? Like a Chinese restaurant. That's like where you get ramen and stuff a lot of times. So really cool, man. So that was kind of interesting. I was kind of wondering like why you guys ended up in Canada when you guys had like a, you know, that going on in Japan, your family. So you're born in Canada and stuff. And then
I am. Yes.
How did you learn how to make ramen? Was it like through your dad did you go to school or, you know, like they have those.
No, there's no ramen.
There's like today's day and age, like Rajuku Tokyo Ramen Academy, and then like I think Mencho has one now. Like they're popping up now, but I don't know when you learned if they had anything like that back in the day.
That's great.
Years ago. Yeah.
I wish. No, I was so I loved cooking even at a young age, and I was already cooking as soon as I graduated high school. So I'm 30 now, but I was cooking since 17, you know, in the kitchen. Really learning everything online here, the kind of Western kitchen style, and learning how to, you know, drop fries, cook burgers, you know, cook steaks, learned everything online. And then after that, I went on to help a little restaurant called Donburiya. And there we had ramen, very simple ramen, you know, and ramen and rice bowls. It was kind of like a convenient, very fast paced restaurant. So it was really good experience for me to just get in there, get in the kitchen and start tossing some noodles. So yeah, that was like 2008. And then after that, I went ahead and cooked at a izakaya, a very famous one here in Vancouver. Shout out to Hapa Izakaya. And I spent a lot of time there working on my staff meal craft, you know, cooking noodles for the staff. And that was a lot of fun, actually. And 2010, 2011. So by 2011, I actually got in touch again with my old boss from Donburiya, and he told me about this new project, Genia, coming to Vancouver. And
oh yeah, that's like famous, like kind of like, like a franchise or what is it? Like you have so many locations everywhere.
Yes. So Virginia is doing very successful right now, I think. And you know, it's a very, very nice brand now. But at the time we only had a few locations in Hollywood and LA, just I think two or three. And the franchise owner was actually a izakaya company, and they didn't have too much ramen experience, but they knew ramen was a good concept to run with. And through their success, they decided to open a location here in Vancouver. And then I was headhunted essentially by my old boss. He brought me in, and before I knew it, I was painting, you know, painting the kitchen white with my kitchen pants and everything, getting ready. And we opened that bad boy up. It was really fun. It was a really good experience. Yeah.
That's great. Did your dad have any aspirations of you to continue in ramen, or was it kind of just like you do whatever you want and you just kind of found your way back to it? Like, what was that like?
Because
I know a lot of times like people who are in the industry and they're like, oh, don't do this, it's so hard. Like, or it's either one or two ways, right? Like either they're like, you work for me and you're gonna work for me till you're 50. Then when I die, you take over. Or it's like, don't ever do what I'm doing, right? It's usually one.
Right. Yeah. Well, my dad has a very fascinating history, work history. So he's been part of the industry for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I can rant about him all day. So after he brought the noodle machine here to Vancouver, he had to sell the machine to a different company and stuff. And he helped open a really famous sushi restaurant. It was Vancouver's or North America's all-star sushi restaurant with AAA chefs and everything, like super high quality products. But Vancouver was not ready for that, you know. That didn't work out, that project. But he was only a manager, and then he moved on to open his own sushi restaurant called Octopus Garden, and he really loved that. And he loved the Beatles, so he named it Octopus Garden. And so now he stepped away from that project, but that's still Vancouver's, you know, one top five sushi restaurant, super gourmet.
Yeah,
that was really awesome. Good, really fun for him. And then in 93, we opened the original Gyoza Paradise. So I was only three at the time. And that's where our name comes from. Our restaurant's called Gyopara. And it's the abbreviation of Gyoza Paradise. And I've always dreamed to kind of bring back from the ashes, you know, the original Gyoza Paradise. Essentially, we were located in the direct middle of Vancouver city center. And the whole block got demolished for new buildings. And our restaurant had a limited timeline, essentially. Like, we didn't know when it was gonna happen, but yeah, they demolished the whole block down. So
I see.
It didn't last long.
Similar things have happened in Hawaii on Oahu, where they had like some restaurants that were there, and then they're like, we don't know how long we're going to be here because they're going to build a big building here soon.
Yeah.
And they just basically had to some of them moved and survived, and some just like, forget it. Or just like, we invested so much into this location, and then I have to like basically getting told we're going to get torn down. So
yeah, super unfortunate.
Yeah. But that's cool, man. You kind of brought back the brand and kind of reinvented
that's
it.
Right.
So how was that? Like, did you kind of talk to your dad, like, hey, I'm thinking about kind of going off on my own again and doing Gyoza Paradise. I want to bring it back. Or was he like, hey, come back and do this? Like, what was that like? What was the impetus for bringing it back, you know?
Oh, okay. Well, it's kind of a long story. But yeah, we were very passionate about cooking again. So my father, after that project, he continued to work with a Canadian coffee company called Blends Coffee. And he worked, you know, pretty much from the bottom up. He became the vice president there. And he was probably the main guy to make matcha trend in North America. So what happened is matcha tea is a huge thing now. But essentially, there was like a test run here by Starbucks in Vancouver, because Vancouver is the coffee capital, not Seattle. So,
Starbucks is from Seattle, but Vancouver is the coffee capital.
Yeah, actually, Seattle's like a flagship kind of test kitchen or test runs were all here in Vancouver.
Yeah, that makes sense.
That's where
it's
cooler.
it's more north, so it's better coffee drinking weather, right?
Perhaps, yeah. But essentially, we have a lot of coffee shops here. But essentially, his boss or his partners at the time said, "Oh yeah, we really want to run with this matcha product too. Like, let's make that work." And then he made all these recipes that that really helped it trend. And then Starbucks got back in the matcha game. And then before you know it, everyone loves matcha. Yeah. But anyways, let's get back on track here.
I just find it fascinating that your dad has been like, he was the sushi guy, and now he's the matcha guy, and now he's the ramen guy. Yeah, I love like people like that have those chapters in their life, and like, oh yeah, like, at one point in time he was this, but now he's doing this. And it's kind of interesting, But then, how did he? What was the impetus for bringing the gyopara back and the that?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the chapter that I left off was about Jinya. So I worked at Jinya. And then I stepped away from the project after, you know, we had a nice, successful opening and everything. You know, everything went really smooth. Made a few recipes for them. They didn't have an egg recipe. I had to make them an egg. I'm pretty picky about my eggs. Pretty funny story. So I like my eggs. I like my yolk perfect, essentially. Mm-hmm. And I hate it when the egg yolk is a little yellow. It's not as pretty as, you know, perfect golden yellow, orange. Anyways, so I was like cooking for Jinya, but I didn't want to work for a franchise for too long, you know, because you're not cooking for yourself, you're cooking for someone else. And I stepped away from that project. And a few years later, Nakata-san from Dumbo came to Vancouver seeking, you know, a Canadian partnership for a franchise location. And Dumbo is already a award-winning noodle franchise company from Japan, and they make Hakata fu, you know, tonkotsu ramen. Mm. It's very very good. And since my father, you know, is a businessman, he said, "Oh yeah, like, yeah, I'll help you out. Like, we'll help you establish here in Vancouver." And then we partnered up with them, and before I knew it, I was opening the first Dumbo, international Dumbo location here in Vancouver, Kitsilano. And super successful. We found a really small, you know, hole in the wall kind of small izakaya place that we bought out, you know, and kitchen is super small, but Dumbo, our recipe was really simple. We just have industrial grade, massive pressure cookers that cook the soup. And that's pretty much all you need. And at all gyoza station, you know, it's a very, very small kitchen, but we made it work. Super, super successful project. And, boom, boom, we open up Dumbo Robson, which is the downtown, like, city center, essentially. And we also found another izakaya that was perfect for baking, and perfect location. And now Dumbo has really established themselves as a really powerful, successful franchise. It's really good. And so we did that. And shout out to Zenta. Zenta is still running around opening locations in like Brooklyn, Seattle, and he's a boy.
I guess once you have the formula that works, you just gotta recreate the magic everywhere.
You just need some talented, you know, line cooks, because these franchises, you know, they're very main central kitchen based. You know, they send stuff from Japan that we used, and really made everything easy. But, you know, same problem with me again. You know, I was getting angsty. Like, wanted to make my own noodles. Couldn't be boxed in by those franchise recipes. And, you know, I stepped away from that as well. And that was 2016, I want to say. That was very fun, very successful. We had a great team. And, after that, my father decided you didn't want to do coffee forever, right? You wanted to get back in the game and kind of establish good craft ramen here in Vancouver. And I really wanted to do that. It's pretty much been my dream to make you know, your own ramen and serve it to everyone. So here I am, just making ramen every day.
Yeah. That's pretty cool, man. How do you, you've been involved in like at least three either franchise shops or your own shops openings. Uh-huh. Like, what are some of the like a lot of people that listen to the show, like they're trying to do pop-ups. Like a lot of them are home cooks that are trying to transition like to pop-ups or stuff, or to work getting maybe potentially having their own shop. And some are like, they have a shop and they're just starting out. And the dream for a lot of these people are, I want to have my own shop one day, right? Mm-hmm. Like, what are things that people should be looking for? I mean, I guess in terms of like, what's the best things that they could do to ensure success, at least in the beginning, to make sure that they can last that first year, 2 years, 3 years? Because it sounds like that Dambo place is still kicking, you know, like, and that Jinya is Jinya, so it's going to be like, you know, they kind of have it down. So what have you learned from those experiences of like opening and even opening your own shop? Like, what are some of the key things that people need to keep in mind when trying to do this thing and for success in the future and stuff?
Well, this year has been tough.
Oh, of course. It's tough for everybody, man. Like,
I can't really give any real good advice because, you know, it's such a volatile market, and it's hard to say what's going to happen in the future. But, and also shout out to all the home cooks. Yeah. Like everyone's making great ramen these days, you know, it's really amazing. But yeah, for a successful project, I don't know, it's hard to say. I mean, obviously working off a franchise was easy work, you know? You don't need to really make any new menus. You're just working off someone else's menu. So in that regard, you know, that success was really easy. Get into those projects really easily. But you know, I'm a big fan of craft ramen and all these pop-ups, you know, making that authentic ramen. And for that to really, you know, blow up, I think there has to be more of a awareness for good craft authentic ramen. Because right now, especially in North America, you know, everyone's kind of eating that kind of generic, franchise driven, kind of same old ramen, you know? And I really wish we would have more of a big scene like Japan.
How do you, I got a question actually from the previous guest's name is Alex as well. He asked the question for you. He's like, how do you tell, just for the general person, how can a general person walk into a shop and just tell like, oh yeah, this shop is doing everything from scratch or trying really hard to make something on their own. And this shop is emptying soup from Japan shipped to them and heating up. Nothing wrong with that. Cause that's like, there's a reason why those shops are successful. Like those stuff, that stuff tastes really good too. So like, how can someone tell, you know, like.
Well, the answer is you can't tell. Because the truth is, even in Japan, they do that.
Yeah, for sure.
It's food for the people. So, you know, it's very common for little hole in the wall shops in Japan to do that or, you know, so, you know, you can't just tell off, you know, you can't just tell off, you know, just the environment. I mean, on our signs, it says, you know, we're making everything, but hopefully there's more awareness. So people like to, you know, find those kind of craft shops and kind of become more like ramen nerds that they like that kind of authentic experience. And hopefully we have more competition when it comes to that. And we build up more of a craft ramen scene here in Vancouver. So
it's such a hard thing too, right? Because like you're in this price point of like burgers and things like that. But to prep for burgers is like, oh, you're going to roll out like a bunch of burger patties to smash the next day or something, you know, like, but ramen, you're spending hours making every single thing. It's the prep and the involvement into making a bowl of ramen. And then you're going to sell it at the exact same price as a burger that someone just like got some ground meat and smashed. And, you know, burgers are great and everything, but just in terms of time to prep something like that versus ramen, it's like,
for sure,
not even close, you know? So I would say like, I can fully understand why people use any kind of soup bases and things, because that's pretty much the only way you can make it where you can keep up with a burger shop. But that's something that I'm trying to figure out too, like how do you promote craft ramen and kodawari ramen and things like that. So people, just educating people to know like, oh, there is a difference, but if the taste difference is negligible, then the market's gonna kind of just decide, like, that's something that's things that I think about quite a probably too much. As someone who doesn't even own a restaurant, I think about it too much. But
yeah, it's a very loaded question. I mean, you know, because people are hungry for ramen.
Yeah.
And there's suppliers that make, you know, concentrates and stuff. So people that want to open up a ramen restaurant, they have a lot of the tools there to, you know, get their foot in the door in that regard, for sure. But yeah, like people want to move volumes, and it's difficult to make a lot of product.
Especially if you're doing like pythons and things, right? Like
yeah, pythons super difficult.
Yeah. And that's what's popular. So it's like, how do you even do that? Right. What is the ramen scene like in Vancouver? Like, is there like a high demand for ramen?
Yes.
I've heard that there's a lot of Asian, there's a big Asian community in Vancouver
that's
too.
Right.
But just in general, like compared to like the other big cities New York City is kind of like, New York City and LA and America is kind of like the ramen hubs, I guess people would say.
Like, yeah, so we're kind of like a little LA, I guess, because you have a really big Asian community. And we have a lot of ramen restaurants too. Yeah. And everyone likes tonkotsu. Everyone likes tonkotsu and paitan. Yeah, two big hitters here.
Yeah, I can imagine, man. Yeah. It's so, just like, I feel like this is my theory. I have no proof of this or whatever, but I feel like the reason people like those things, like the thick paitan soups, is it's so different than instant ramen. And most people grew up in America eating instant ramen, and they have an image of this Chintan Shoyu instant ramen that came from a soup packet.
Oh yeah, that could be it, yeah.
Yeah, and so like when they taste tonkotsu ramen, like, wow, this is a completely different experience. And it's like, and it tastes really good, of course, you know?
Rich.
Yeah, rich and
creamy. They want that rich experience.
Yeah. Have you seen any kind of progression towards any kind of other exploration into chintans? Like, is there any shop in Vancouver just saying like, hey, we only do shoyu ramen? Like in New York City, there is a couple of, like, right. Nakamura-san's place in New York, he does predominantly chintan, like tanneke kind of things, and he doesn't do like too much tonkotsu at all. Right. And so there's a little bit level of acceptance there. There's also like, I think it's, I forget the name, Ishida, they're doing that same thing too. Is there any kind of progression towards that, or is it just like, no, we love the tonkotsu here, we love that tonkatsu ramen?
Yeah. Tonkatsu, yeah, very popular. Yeah, we have a few, you know, good locations that kind of hold down that Shintan style.
Oh really? Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, and hopefully people kind of gravitate towards that more as they kind of expand their ramen palette and really, you know, start to diversify their options. And you know, you start to really, well, I've grown older and I've learned to respect the Chintan kind of light broth a lot more.
Yeah.
I don't eat tonkotsu like I used to.
Yeah, me too. I'm 38. I can't do that anymore.
Yeah. So, but there's also people that, you know, fast and want to break their fast with like a big jiro or something.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, greasy, really just, you know, indulge in the experience as well. So you got to respect both sides of the spectrum, really. And I do really see, I have a lot more respect for, you know, everyone's different tastes. But personally, Gyopara here, we do chintan everything pretty much. Shoyu is pretty much our staple, but tonkotsu is much more popular. We do a tonkotsu from our Niban. So it's very, very limited amount compared to our chintan.
That's actually a great idea to do it for restaurants. Like, you can basically double use the bones for both. And
yeah, you gotta add more, but essentially you can do a constant,
stretch it out a little bit. Yeah,
that's a classic Tokyo style. Essentially, you know, what you do is you take your ichiban, your chintan, and then you work with what you got left and try to make a tonkotsu there. But it's a little different from Hakata, you know, Kyushu style. You work with pork heads.
Yeah,
that might be a little bit of a shock for some of your listeners, but yeah, it's pork heads, which is Kyushu style.
I was telling my dad last night, I was having dinner with him, and he was like, he's like a big fan of my YouTube channel, and like just like happy, but he's like he loves tonkotsu ramen too,
right?
And I was like, did you know they put pork heads in it? That's what they use in Japan. And he's like, that's gross, I wouldn't eat that. I was like, you probably ate it in Japan, like you just didn't know that you ate it, like the brains and all,
right?
Probably just don't know.
Yeah, the brain's got lots of good minerals. Fats and, yeah, but that style is good. Yeah, we use genkotsu, which is all, you know, the femur. It's very rich in the bone marrow content. It gives it that richness, classic Tokyo style. So that's a little bit different. So when I was with Dumbo, we used all Kyushu, classic Kyushu style, which I really respect. It's kind of like a lighter broth because it's using the pork heads. And also I really respect the pressure cooker that we use there. Because when you think of Kyushu, when you think of Hakata, you think of like all strong pork scent, you know, overpowering like aromas, you know, almost like it's got an aura to it, you know, the restaurants, like, you know, when you go there. But Dumbo really made a name for themselves by using those industrial pressure cookers and, you know, having a really fast extraction for the broth and gives it like a really very fast, fresh, a really freshness to it that that cuts a lot of the funk from the recipe. Yeah. Because working with pork heads, you're going to get a lot of funk. You got to do a lot of scumming.
I had a question about that, like how the technology has gotten so much better in just in terms of everything, right? Like we have of this stuff now. Mm-hmm. What do you think? All right, there was another question here. I forgot what I was going to ask. What do you think, like, you're doing in your shop in Gilpata that's, you know, different and maybe better than what your family did in the past, in the previous Gilpata and in Yoyokan, you know, like, what do you think that the tech upgrades have been in terms of, like, making ramen your way?
Well, we go pretty old school. We don't use any pressure cookers.
Oh, really?
Pressure cookers, it's Chintan based, right? So
that's true.
Our miso, we make our miso at home and, or here. And you know, that's how we make our miso ramens, but just shoyu base, that's our classic. And then, so no pressure cooker is needed, but I really, really respect the pressure cooker for sure. Just the technology for that is outstanding. We're old school in that regard.
How do you balance your respect for tradition and, you know, like your family's lineage and what they were doing in the past? I guess it's a little bit different because your dad and your grandpa also had this huge manufacturing company, but just in terms of like balancing the traditions of ramen and today's market, especially serving ramen outside of Japan, you know, like, and, like how do you balance those two things?
Personally, I like to respect the ingredients and really respect not relying on additives and stuff like that. That's my personal kind of approach to the whole thing. I'm a pretty spiritual person too, and I don't like my food to be junk food. You know, sometimes we all have our times where, you know, we fiend, you know, a bag of chips or you want to junk out. But when it comes to my ramen, I want it to be like transparent, and I want the ingredients to speak for itself. You know, working with natural glutamates and working with natural kind of umami components. So I think that's one of the biggest factors when it comes to industrialized ramen making, you know, everything being prepackaged. It's just really easy to rely on preservatives that keep, you know, everything, and also like, you know, artificial flavoring.
Yeah, the science-based umami stuff, like you can just sprinkle in that, you know, inosinic acid MSG. MSG and stuff. I mean, that's like, if you can use it properly, I guess it's like not that big a deal, but it definitely is probably cheaper and easier to do that than extract everything from, you're trying to extract that inosinic acid from fish and chicken and pork and extract that glutamate from kombu or shiitake.
Yeah. Again, MSG is not going to kill you, obviously, but it is an interesting subject.
I talk a lot of shit about pythons, but actually I don't care. I think they taste great too. I just think that it can be dangerous if that is the only thing people think about as ramen, and they get burnt out on that because they get older and they can't handle that.
The python.
Python sitting in their stomach for the whole day, you know, like, I just think it'd be a better for the ramen industry as a whole in America is if people were aware that there's other styles that you can eat and not feel like complete shit after, you know, like sometimes, you know, like, and just for the longevity sake of it. I have nothing against tonkotsu ramen. It's awesome. Like it tastes so good.
It's like a cheap day meal.
I just think about that. Like, you know, it's like it's better to like, not just, you know, the opportunities are there to educate people that there's other styles that you could eat when you're not feeling that great. Your friends want to go for ramen, but there's something else you can eat rather than, you know, sometimes you don't want to eat that. Sometimes you don't feel that great and you don't want to eat something that's going to make you feel worse in a couple hours. So
yeah, for sure.
Can we talk about, let's talk about Gyopara now, like your Gyopara. Sure. Of course, right now, like it's kind of, COVID is messing up everything. Like there's so many businesses and restaurants closing down here where we are at. So I'm sure you're trying to figure out how to navigate that. Like, what have you been doing? Like, how's it been? And you can be honest, you know, like, I mean, it's probably, I can just imagine, like, I heard Vancouver is actually not bad. I heard Canada as a whole is not bad. Like, right, they're doing the Stanley Cup playoffs in Canada for a reason, in the bubble in Edmonton.
Yeah,
and so, yeah, but I don't know Vancouver. Here. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not, yeah, it's nothing like America. Everyone's, you know, just walking around, enjoying the sun. And but when it comes to like, people visiting restaurants, yeah, like our business has been hit pretty hard. And we've been trying to combat that by, you know, focusing a little bit more on to-go. And that reminds me, I was watching your Ivan episode. It's really good. He was saying the same thing about making ramen for everyday ramen, I think you're saying.
Yeah,
because he loves his simple ramen. We've been doing a lot of our to-go stuff, DoorDash, Uber Eats, Skip, things like that. But you know, like your previous guests have said, you know, as a ramen chef, you really don't want to do to-go. We do make yourself kits as well. Like we do like raw noodles, like little instruction pamphlets, stuff for the nerds that, you know, want to blanch their own noodles and have fun, you know, at home.
But it's just all that stuff just adds friction, right? Like it's how do you, like that seems to be the biggest challenge now with these, you're trying to pivot and like kind of innovate a little bit. But like making someone boil noodles and mix things, like it just adds friction and people would much rather just let me microwave something and pour it in. And that's like why there's a lot of places that do that. But it's just like, how do you, you know, you have your beliefs as a chef, you want this to be consumed in a certain way. And where do you draw that line is always so hard for me to figure out. I mean, I don't have to figure it out because I'm not doing anything anyway, but I mean, imagine for you guys, you know?
Yeah, well, to tell you the truth, there's always been demaicho in Japan. You know?
That's true.
Scooters. Guys bring you bowl noodles on a scooter.
So
can't be too strict, you know. People have always been into go.
That's true. How do you, in terms of just like operating restaurant, this is like aside from COVID, how do you balance that desire to serve the best quality ramen with the realities of cost and profit margins and things like that?
Yeah.
How do you, what things do you feel like just personally, like, okay, we can do this to stretch costs. Like you kind of mentioned the Nibban, you're doing Nibban, the pythons and things like, or like, how do you balance that? You know, like what are you doing to balance those two things? Cause it sounds like you have a strong desire to serve really kotowari, you know, bowls. But you still have to run a business.
I don't know. I would say it's my my own slave labor. I'm here all day, every day. So maybe that's helping with the cost. But you know, it's a passion project. You know, it's really just blood, sweat, and tears that go into this. You know, we're here every day, you know, holding it down. I think that's one of the main things you got to have. Passionate chefs that really love what they're doing. I think that's one of the core things, you know, that goes beyond profit margins and things like that, for sure. And you got to balance everything. I mean, our menu is pretty small. What it is, it looks big because we have a vegetarian menu, but we just focus on what we like, our few bowls, you know, and our gyozas. And just try to, and our fried rice, and kind of just try to make the best of that. And I think a lot more people want to have that kind of specialty house experience, where they can kind of, you know, go to a specialty store instead of going to like a, you know, a big selection restaurant where you can just kind of pick and choose and stuff. I think that's going to die down more as we move into a new era where, you know, people specialize in their craft. And hopefully, you know, people come to us for our style of ramen. And that speaks to them.
Yeah, that's true. I think fast casual is kind of like, I can't imagine like people younger than you digging like, I really want to go to Applebee's. You know, not just not that they're Applebee's under the bus, but you know, like it doesn't seem like the Generation Z kind of thing. Like, fuck, I'm really craving some Red Lobster right now. You know, it's more like, oh, do you check out? You should go check out this really craft, you know, high end ramen place. Rather, like, it just seems like the consumer demands are shifting away from that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
cool, man. Yeah, I mean, it's like, what, so can we talk a little bit about making ramen? Because a lot of people here
let's change it up.
Making ramen. Mm-hmm. I just find it interesting. Like, I love all this, the shop talk and business stuff too, but what tips and advice do you have for people who are trying to make ramen? Like, what are you focusing on when you're making ramen? Like, what do you make first? And then what do you base that on? Like, I've heard lots of other people say that they make this noodles first and then base everything around that. Or tare first, base it around that. Like, what is your approach to making something?
Well, it all comes down to the mood. I think food cooking in general, you know, it's very emotion driven. So if you're looking for that kind of big, rich, ultimate dining experience, you know, going hard for that tonkotsu, then obviously then your broth is set. You're going to make that tonkotsu. You're committed to it. You know, or a paitan, tori paitan, you know, going for that, you know, savory chicken profile. So, you know, kind of, you know, nail those moods out and then go from there, you know, because at the end of the day, you can pair any noodles to your broth, honestly. We let our customers choose their noodles after. Really? Yeah, so we pair our noodles with, you know, their default settings. So our tonkotsu comes thin, our tantanmen comes medium, but they have the option to, you know, go with temomi. Like, well, I'm going to go for temomi today, and they have the choice to do that. So, you know, it's personal preference really at the end of the day when it comes to pairing your noodles. So, you know, I'd say, you know, figure out your broth. I think that's really important. Broth is like the centerpiece for your ramen experience. And I would say broth.
So focus on that. Are you like, I've heard that some people say that, or not, there's a book that I have that talks about this, that there's certain ways to approach tare. It's that you go soup first, focus on soup, and then tare is a complement to the soup.
Right.
And then there's other shops that go tare first because they don't know if the consistencies of the product that they're going to get is going to change. So it sounds like your thing is more soup first and then tare complements is back to the soup.
So yeah, I've listened to some of your past guests and they're so informative and such. Yeah, some really good guests. Yeah, I definitely resonate with the fact that the tare is kind of like complementary to the broth. But like your guests have said in the past, if you can stabilize and, you know, make your tare solid, then it definitely helps, you know, create consistency in the broth and everything, for sure. But I'm a simple person, you know. I like my tare really simple, for shoyu, at least. But for miso and stuff, yeah, you can get pretty creative in that miso tare. I can get into that later. Yeah, I got a few tips for miso. Yeah,
oh, might as well just share them now. I just tried to do miso and it was freaking.
Okay. I loved your video.
I put so much work into that one, and like, to be honest, like, it was okay. But I just, first of all, it's like 90 degrees in Hawaii when I was eating it, and so it's hard to eat, like, for me anyway. Like, something super hot, and when it's hot everywhere and it's super humid, but I always struggle with miso. Like, what tips can you get from miso ramen?
Me too. Oh yeah. So like I said, you know, our history comes from that classic Tokyo shoyu kind of, you know, very traditional chuka soba style, not Sapporo or anything. So miso has been secondary to that shoyu profile, you know? So I had to do a lot of my own homework and a lot of my own studying to really satisfy my own miso standards. You know, also I've been to Japan many times. I lived there for a month and all you did was eat ramen. so I, you know, I've experienced some different types of ramen, and miso is difficult. It's, you know, if you have unbalanced miso paste, it can overpower and be too salty and kind of overpower the natural flavors that are delicate in the broth. Or, you know, it could be too much or too little. It could be almost like miso soup, you know, where it's just not enough punch. And yeah, it's definitely a craft in its own. But yeah, I got a few miso tips. One that's a tip in general is aging. Flavors change with age. And that goes for our tare. And that goes for miso, obviously, as well as a fermentation, you know. The miso cures all the ingredients inside of it. So you don't be afraid to, you know, toss some stuff in there and just leave it in the fridge for weeks, you know. Some places leave their miso paste in jars and just let it sit for months, you know, to let that all those flavors really, you know, combine and evolve, which is really fascinating. But yeah, so the two major tips that I have for miso lovers and people trying to up their miso game is to throw in a lot of chopped onions. So this might come to surprise some people, but it's really, really simple. It's just like cooking curry, you know? To make good curry, you gotta caramelize a lot of onions.
So are you putting in caramelized onions, or are you putting
in... That's right. So what I used to do in the past is I was lazy, just toss some onions in there, you know, blend it. But it was not enough. And that caramelization, that is where the sweetness and that all that flavor, you know, it's just a cooking basic, you know, basic 101 is caramelization. And it's super, super useful when making your miso, is to just, you know, caramelize a lot of onions and blend it into your tare and combine your tare, and then combine that with your miso paste, and then let that sit for in your fridge for, you know, as long as you can.
I know that there's like so much salt in miso and things, and it's probably okay, but it's always like, man, is this really going to be okay? Like, you got like cooked onions and garlic and ginger in here, and
yeah, it's okay. Yeah, because it's cured. It's, the miso will preserve it in its own way, with its own way. Miso is a very fascinating ingredient. You know, it can last in your fridge forever.
It just gets darker and darker as you just let it sit. I have some shiro miso that's like red, dark red. It's like, I found it at the back of my fridge. Like, oh, I think it's still edible, but I don't know if it tastes like what it's supposed to taste like anymore. Or it maybe tastes better. Do you have any tips for like any of the other styles of tare? Like, I recently did the Sano-san shio tare. Mm-hmm. And I was so like skeptical of that one because it's just like, ton of like salt in a dashi, basically. That's all it was, but it's pretty amazing. And the thing that's been most fascinating for me is that it's been getting better as it just sits in my fridge and ages a little bit.
Oh, nice.
Which I thought, you know, be counter to like, oh, I thought dashi components die, you know, like, yeah, that's what I've always heard and been told, like, oh, dashis die in a day or two. So but I just kept it in there. I talked to Keizo about it, and he's like, maybe it'll get better, because I guess that's what he does. He keeps his shiotaris for a long time and ages them. And it's been getting better and better. So I'm just kind of curious if you have any kind of like secret pro tips. Shout out to the Discord for like the shoyu tares and shio tare, shio dare, you know, these things like that.
So yeah, well, the secret pro technique, the secret is that, yeah, all these, you know, old school restaurants, they have what's called like a house like sauce, like house tare, that's really old.
Like a mother tare, yeah, kind mother of tare, just keeping it going. Wow.
You know, it's that kind of concept is kind of new to the West. You know, you kind of think it's like unsafe or something, but I mean, you're giving, so it's not really old, but it helps kind of create a distinct flavor profile that gives a certain kind of age to it, and it's really fascinating. And you only work with, you know, super salinity, like super soy sauces and stuff. You don't want to have any kind of extra moisture. You don't want to have too much water content or anything when you work with aging, because that's going to get in your way. But yeah, I'd say, well, we are our house style is chassis driven. So the the secret, I'll let you in on the secret. When you braise your chassis, and then you have kind of like a braising chassis liquid, that chassis liquid isn't the secret tare. It's actually is a second sauce that you rest the chassis in, because hot chassis, if you don't rest it, it's going to dry up a bit. So you let it marinate, not in the hot temperature, but you let it marinate in like the cold shoyu. And then that gives it a chance to kind of like sponge, take all that the juices without bleeding, you know? And because you don't want lean dry chashu. and then you can create like a special, essentially chashu infused tare that uses that kind of helps that soy sauce lose kind of its edge, and it becomes house sauce essentially.
That's interesting. I think what you're referring to in Japanese, they call it shiokado, right? That's what they're calling it.
What
is that? Like, what? Like, I've read it in recipe books a lot. Like, how would you describe that in English? Like, okay, well, what is that? Is it that sharp?
It's like, sharp, yeah.
That sharp kind of like, stinging, salty. Like, it hurts. Right. It's so salty, it hurts kind of thing. Is that what it is? So, I'm not sure what it is.
You can test this at home. So, kado means corner or edge. In kanji, and it's pretty good, pretty good one-to-one translation, kind of like the edge to that profile. You can test this at home. You just taste a little bit of soy sauce. It has that distinct kind of kick to it. But then if you boil or bring to a boil, you taste that same soy sauce, and all of a sudden it has different aromatic profile, and all of a sudden doesn't have that kick anymore. That's kind of like you losing the edge on that soy sauce. And that's very common for Japanese sauces, whether it be for like a donburi, like a rice bowl, or teriyaki, you cook the soy sauce or reduce it with meeting and, dashi and sake, whatever it be. So it's very common in Japanese cuisine to cook the soy sauce. But yeah, or just having the chashu help that can even just change the kado for sure.
Interesting. Yeah, I always see that word in like recipe books and things, and it's like, I was like, what is that? Because I know what the words mean, but I'm always like, what does that taste like? When I just taste stuff, it's like, I think that's what they're talking about.
Yeah.
All right. We got a bunch of listener questions we can start getting into.
All right.
Let's see. So we got a lot of questions about gyoza, actually.
Oh, because
gyopara, the name, I guess. So Royal Ramen was asking if you have any advice for making gyoza. Pro techniques for gyoza.
It's definitely an art too. Obviously, having a really good blender helps, because you don't want to destroy that cabbage cellular wall. Because you want to be salting that cabbage. Cabbage is the primary ingredient, by the way, for Japanese traditional gyoza.
Interesting.
Quite fascinating, yeah. So, dumplings, there's so many different types of dumplings, but from Manchuria, they had a lot of immigrants from Manchuria come to Japan, and they established their Manchurian dumpling style. And that's, the classic Japanese gyoza now. It's very cabbage-driven. Because, you go to China, you got a lot of, meaty or... Foodie gyozas or dumplings, but the classic Japanese gyoza is Manchurian. Pretty interesting. And so cabbage is super important because cabbage is full of water, and without correct salting and correct massaging, you're going to have different hydration levels in your neta, so I think that's actually one of the key factors. You can scoop out your salts and your sauces and perfect to the gram. But if you don't have consistent gyoza technique that can really massage the cabbage of its excess water, but not too much. You don't want to dry it out too much. You gotta find the sweet spot for that. I think that's really important to find that little sweet spot. I think that's probably the most important factor that can create variables in your gyoza content. Besides that, yeah, it's a lot of love.
You guys make all your own gyoza too, right? Like, do you guys even
That's
make the
right.
wrappers and stuff? Because the wrappers are like,
No, we don't
that's like
make
next
wrappers.
level.
Yeah, that's like home for like your family or something. Just a few hundred, you know, not thousands.
you're gonna roll out like 1,000 little wrappers. A little bit nuts. Okay, let's
But I do
see.
love a thick wrapper.
Oh yeah,
I do
thick
love
wrappers.
thick wrappers. Are
I was trying to figure out how to make those. I have no idea even how they're even made. Like, I've seen some people on YouTube and stuff just make them when they're making noodles. They just cut an extra slab and rather than cut the noodles.
There's still kansui in there, but
there's still kansui in there.
There's no kansui.
Oh, no kansui in there. Yeah. Huh, interesting.
But essentially, yeah, you would make a little play dough, kind of like little snakes.
Yeah, yeah.
Dough, and then you would cut them into little slices of cylinders, and then you can palm them down into a nice little circle. And then get a little roller and then roll out the edges.
Interesting. So there's like no like kansu in there. So it's like super high hydration, kind of like.
Yeah.
Like, that's oh, interesting. How do you guys do, this is a question from B4R. How do you guys do gyoza for service? Are you like doing it made to order or are you keeping it hot?
So we make them in house and then we have a little freezer to freeze them. And I know, you know, some people like freshly wrapped, but you know, it is a ramen restaurant, so
yeah.
you gotta pick and choose. But essentially, freshly wrapped is not possible. not even in a gyoza restaurant.
Like, yeah, you just wait 30 minutes for your gyoza to come
yeah.
out.
yeah, yeah, it's literally not possible. Yeah. But you know, freezing, you cannot underestimate the power of frozen food products. You know, the reason why Tsuki Man, you know, I talked about Tsuki Man in the past, became so powerful is because, you know, in the age where no one had freezers and people only had cellars, you know, it was a huge product. But like frozen foods preserve the ingredients, you know, it's like, I don't want to say cryogenic freezing, it preserves the ingredients and kind of time walks it, you know. And anyone, you know, the listeners that love, you know, crafting noodles, homemade noodles, know that the aging process is super important to, you know, find a sweet spot, you know, trying to find out what stage in the aging cycle of your noodles that you like and stuff. So freezing noodles at the most pristine moment kind of would essentially preserve the quality. And the same can be said for gyozas, you know. So we make them fresh and then we freeze them and then we just take them out to order it's great.
Cool. That's a good tip on the noodles. I usually just like make noodles, leave them in the fridge. Like, oh shit, they're getting kind of old in there. Let me put them in the freezer. It's not like I'm trying to like capture the best thing.
Don't bring it to freezer.
Yeah, I should maybe be more deliberate and thoughtful on that. Like, okay, mm-hmm. It tasted great this day. I should put them in the freezer rather than
like mark it on the calendar.
Yeah,
you know, so you kind of know where it's at in its life.
How do you do that? Like, how do you judge like the aging if it's aged appropriately and like what is your markers for those kind of things?
Well, I mean, every noodle is different.
Yeah, of course.
But I don't know. Just a few, you would have to rest it a few days, I would say. And if you freeze them, you know, 3-4 days later, that's a pretty good benchmark. You know, you take it from there. Obviously, home cooking is difficult in its own right. It's not the same thing as mass producing the same mm-hmm. same thing over and over. But yeah,
there's so many more variables in home cooking. Have you ever tried to make ramen at home? Like it's a pain in the butt.
I make pastas, but like yeah, I've been spoiled since because the noodle machine that I grew up with and stuff.
Yeah,
that's not my specialty. I do love all the science, like the premium, like potassium content.
Yeah.
Having high potassium compared to sodium. Factors like that can change it.
And
yeah, like it's really fascinating, really. And hydration levels, like I said, the atmosphere can even change it. Like sometimes, you know, it's hot, that's gonna completely change your noodle, get softer than you wanted it to be. And yeah, I think also one of the major factors is like how you form the gluten, like, you know, in the noodles. That's super important. You don't, it's in Japanese, it's called koshi. when you have kind of that resistance when you chew into that noodle, I really think that's one of the primary factors I look for when you're making noodles or when you're buying noodles or whatever it may be, that koshi factor. People from the South Kyushu style, they use thin noodles, but the thin noodles, you can't create that same koshi, you know? So you kind of have to rely on firmness, which is not the same thing. Firmness, yeah. So that's why it's such a huge, I don't want to say meme, but going hard on noodles, like barikata, harigane,
yeah.
You can go pretty hard on the thin noodles, but that's not the same thing. Like, I'm not a fan of that. I don't like when you try to mask the al dente, that iconic bite in your noodles with firmness. So hopefully, people kind of try to find that happy middle ground where you can get that chew without, sacrificing anything.
Yeah, all those things that you said, like, it really reminded
hard
me, like, how there's all this specialized, like, yogo for all these Japanese terms for things that a lot of people in the West don't even think about, like the koshi, and the men's noodles koshi and things like that. Like, I don't think people, I don't even think about that stuff. And then it's freaking nuts, man. So we got a couple of troll-ish questions. I've reworded them because in a way, because I think some of these things are interesting because, so I'm going to set up this first question. In the Discord server, you've said in the past, you've talked about the double pour, and the double pour is right. Like you're pouring the soup into, and I do it a lot in my videos. So I'm also gonna do this. And so, Chika Ramen asks, in Ramen Heads, Tomita does a double pour. How does that make you feel?
Well, I mean, you can double pour all you want. it's not gonna change dramatically. The discussion we had in the Discord was about harigane and konotoshi and just serving pretty much raw noodles, like Hakata fu, really, really sensitive product, because some of these noodle blanches are only 2 seconds. And konotoshi is 2 seconds. And you can just imagine how sensitive the noodles are, it's like 2 second blanch, it doesn't even make sense. Like, it's so hard. So we were on that discussion, on the topic of, trying to have the noodles cook in the soup, essentially, as you serve
I see.
So, of course, you want to serve the hottest product possible. I make sure the ceramic content, the porcelain content in my bowls are good, and I make sure that my bowls are super hot. So hot to the point that I can't even touch them. And that's how I like to serve my noodles, very last second. So it's about a 52-second blanch time for my noodles. And for that, it gives me, less than a minute to prepare the tare, the oils, and everything. And then I pour my boiling hot soup into the bowl as the timer rings. So, you want to put your love into the craft and serve fast as you can. And that's where that kind of this funny discussion came up about double pour. I coined that term essentially. It's not a big deal. But I have a background. My mother and my grandmother are matcha ceremony tea artists.
Oh, I see. Yeah. So now I understand a little bit more.
Right.
Yeah.
So and in the tea world, you boil you got a kettle of water, and then you pour it into your cups, your little, your cups, and then that cools down temperature significantly. Mm-hmm. So I just implemented the same kind of theory that and also like was Filipino or Southeast Asian coffee stunts where they like cool the coffee down by pouring it. That
are you talking about the one that they're doing those huge pour things?
Like, huge pours. So I thought, hey, well, I guess every pour will affect the temperature of my soup. So I should be more thoughtful and be aware of that instead of doing multiple shenanigans like in school. So that's where that discussion came from. I mean, if you're gonna double pour, I mean, go ahead. No one's gonna stop you. It's not a big deal.
I do that all the time, and I'm like, oh,
you know, I'm always trolling on this.
He is judging me as I'm filming this video.
Honestly, double pour is not as big of a problem as a good noodle shake. What bothers me is watery soup, because you put all this love into your soup. You know, your chefs, your cooks, all these, you know, great people put a lot of their love and effort into the profile. Everything's to spec, make that soup perfect. And then you have a line cook that, you know, disrespects that by putting in
they're magic, like, just waving a magic wand, basically. Yeah. They're not,
you can see the water just like being in there. It'll definitely change everything. And
what's your biggest pet peeve when it comes to like ramen making? Like, you see somebody like, God, what do you think? Is that
soggy
it?
Soggy and cold. Soggy and cold ramen, I cannot stand. I would probably just complain. I have, you know, my own restaurant. I have, you know, I can't be, you know, fooling around, but if I could, I would be like, no, I can't take this. Like, yeah, send it back to the kitchen.
That's what I was going to ask you, because when I had Ramen Kawanashi on, and some of the other places, I think Motoki too, they both had shops overseas, like in Southeast Asia.
Nice.
And they said, like, you know, people just don't eat ramen as hot as Japanese people eat it outside of Japan. So, like, how have you seen that in Vancouver too? Like, you said you're serving piping hot ramen.
That's right.
Like, what are they just going to, oh, I'm just going to let that sit and cool down for a little bit.
Exactly. It's piping hot. Yeah. And people will take their time with it. For sure.
I see.
That's just part of the learning curve. Yeah, people still new to the slurping, because the slurping action really oxidizes and cools down significantly. And there's a lot of science behind that too. Like, you know how people that cup wine, or like wine tasters and
for sure,
they always gargle and like kind of oxidize in their mouth and
give
it a little swish. It's kind of like the same concept, where those flavors, when they oxidize, it gives it a huge impact. Like, it changes it dramatically. So the slurping, you know, there's actually a good benefit to slurping. Not only are you able to eat hot food because it cools it down, that oxidization in your mouth, the burst of flavor, you know, it's a little bit of science behind it.
I still can't do it right. Like, I needed to grow up in Japan. Like, I do it and I'm like, my mouth is on fire.
The trick is to get a really small bite.
Okay.
You just pull one bite and you pull it up into the sky, you know, and you let it cool. Because when you pull that one strand up, or two strands up, or whatever it be, and you pull it up, that portion is going to cool down so you can eat it. Whereas it's not going to affect the rest of your bowl. And then you slurp that piece that's untangled. And then, you're good to go.
All right. I'm going to try that next time. Because sometimes I'm like, I don't know how to do this. And it's like, my mouth is all burnt the next day and stuff. All right. So this next question is actually like, so the person asked it. So first of all, I'm going to say this person created a fake account to ask this question, because we had a ramen contest a long time ago. And then there was a mystery person that came in to watch the judging, and it was their name was DJ Pineapple, and they had like a pineapple face and stuff. So anyways, whoever this person is, they made like a fake account. I don't think it's the actual DJ Pineapple that was in the Zoom room at the time.
Right.
But, you know, like, you've gotten into it with some people on the server, and, you know, like, it's hard to have conversations when it's just in text, because you can't, like, that's why I like to do this. Like, I can see your face, you know, I can read your reactions and things. And it's sometimes when we're just typing, it's hard to kind of understand where people are coming from.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
But so this person, they asked this question in a way that was kind of like trying to just goad you on. But I'm actually curious about this in my own, for my own personal reasons. Like, in what ways has DJ Pineapple 69, I like how they added 69 in there to make it extra cool. But in what ways has owning a shop affected you personally? Like, in terms of like the way that you operate in your interactions with people and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Has it changed you in any way, you think?
Yes. Very stressful. So you try to find ways to unwind outside of work, because you're just stressing out, working all day. And it's a Japanese philosophy to, you know, treat your patrons like gods, you know? Gods. So, you know, there's another term called kinsei, where you really put your heart and soul into your work, and you lower yourself, you lower your head, and you really just put your work into your craft. And I definitely live by that. So when I'm here all day, like, you know, I used to work 9 to like 12. Mm-hmm. 9 a.m. to 12 night. Sometimes, you know, you don't have time to sleep because you're just too busy working. Yeah. And things like that, you know, do that every day, it's going to stack up on you. And definitely need ways to, you know, relieve stress. And this year has been a lot of stress for everyone, for sure. And
yeah,
it can definitely get in little, you know, arguments here and there.
Yeah. But I actually like commend you, because, you know, you came in, you apologized, and you've been trying to, you know, be better. And like,
yeah, I was going to.
That's like something for me. Like, I don't care if you fuck up. Like, anybody can. I fuck up all the time. Like, I made like, you know. But if you can kind of apologize and you can make an effort to be better, it's like, fuck, who cares? Like that. Like, you're human, you know. Mm-hmm. Nobody's gonna judge you for that, you know. So I really do appreciate it. You know, I seen what you've been doing on the Discord, and you know, you've been trying to help people, and you're being really positive. So I give you credit, but because I can't imagine how stressful it is to own a restaurant during COVID right now.
Oh yeah. So, like, yeah. 70% of our, they said like 70% of restaurants are going to close down here.
Oh, I can believe it. They said on Kauai, my island, they said 40% of all businesses in general are going to close down next year.
So it's just super stressful for everyone.
And like, I have I don't know if you probably listen to, if you listen to the other podcast, like we had a sale going from my previous business that fell through because of COVID. Mm. And so we have to like kind of scramble and figure out what I'm going to do before I have my next kid in next month. And, so yeah, it's been stressful, like for everybody, for myself included. I haven't been the best person that I feel like I could be. So mm-hmm. yeah. So yeah. But yeah, I just want to say thanks for, you know, what you're doing in the Discord server.
Yeah. Hopefully no one takes my trolling seriously.
No, you're doing,
I'm always good at
that. Yeah, yeah. But like I said, anybody can fuck up and make mistakes. It's how you deal with it after.
For sure.
You know, that speaks more to me than the actual mm-hmm. mistake itself. That's unless you kill somebody on purpose, then it's kind of like, he apologized.
Yeah.
He apologized, but he still kind of killed somebody. Maybe that one is a little bit too much, but you know, I feel like everybody has room for growth in their life. So
for sure. Yeah.
All right. Simon Minard asks, what is your noodle making process in the shop?
Well, since we sold that noodle machine off, we actually have the company make it for us.
Right? Okay.
But you guys know Yamachan Noodle Company. They actually, because of us, I think they came up here into Vancouver, just shut up a new new noodle making plant, new factory. And it's really unfortunate for them too, actually. So we make our own custom noodles with them. And they were supposed to open in November of last year, 2019. But they still haven't opened, I think, and they lost a lot of their main guys, which is unfortunate. But that's something I'm actually looking forward to, is to get into the noodle factories and like get my hands on kind of like Sun Noodle and make more noodles. But yeah, right now our machine is actually located not in the restaurant. The noodle making machine is like 10 feet long, and it's in Chinatown here in Vancouver. And yeah, shout out to Double Happiness Noodles. They're still continuing on and making our noodles for us. And yeah, it's like a classic medium, Nijunishin, I believe, is the size. So the noodle size is determined by Japanese inch. It's like 3 centimeters roughly, I think.
Oh yeah, is that like the when they're giving that, like, what is it called? Yeah. I forget what it's called. Yeah. My Japanese is terrible.
Yeah, ishin.
Ishin. Oh, okay.
So one ishin is about 3 centimeters, and that's divided into 22 like bites. It turns into about 1.36 millimeters, I think. That cut. So those are kind of those little teeth to the machine come in ishin, like those 3 centimeter like little inch teeth. And depending on your noodle machine, because some have a wider set, or you know, a kind of like a thin set, you calculate it by the 3 centimeters at a time,
mm-hmm.
the teeth set in, because you know when you're making noodles, you want to set it by the length. Like certain noodles, you have a certain length, you know. So when it comes out of the machine, that's gonna factor in like the portion sizes and stuff, you know, and that's gonna completely affect everything when you're portioning it. So it's pretty fascinating to like, all this fact, the noodle making things are so interesting.
I find it like that. So in America, we have Sun Noodle. They're like they're from Hawaii, but they have manufacturing plants in New Jersey and California, and I think somewhere in the Midwest, either in Texas or somewhere in the Midwest too. And so like they supply noodles probably almost, I don't know the percentage, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's over 90% of all ramen shops in America get their noodles from Sun Noodle. Mm-hmm. I always find the problem is, unlike, so you guys, you've made noodles before and you know the process of making noodles. So when you order noodles, you can know, I want this thing. I want these characteristics in it. Uh-huh. A lot of people that open shops that don't make noodles, they don't know what noodle matches with the soup.
Right. So one of the pet peeves for me is when people put in too much additives. Like we don't have like any kind of like weird ingredients in the noodles, because if you put too much like egg powder protein or things like that, or any kind of like ingredients that make the noodles too slippery, the noodles don't grasp the soup as well. You know, there's not as much synergy, and I don't like that plasticky feeling in my noodles, so that kind of bothers me. As well as before I forget, I want to mention, like, there's a lot of bounce back when it comes to, you know, when you craft your noodles, when you're sheeting your product, you know, at home especially, you know, it's a lot more difficult. I was going to say one of the good benefits for using an industrial grade machine is you got industrial grade mixers that can work with the hydration levels and get it perfectly mixed. You know, that's super important, because that's going to completely affect the chewiness of the noodles. And then when you're shooting, these massive machines, these massive pin rollers can slowly, you know, sheet your noodles down to the correct size. So it's not going to, once you cut it, it's not going to bounce, you know, become double the size you thought it was going to be, because the massive amount of PSI and the horsepower can really, really help with that.
Yeah, so, for sure.
Yeah, so a lot of love to all you home noodle maniacs that take your time with all that.
There's like a huge, my brother-in-law has like this old like noodle machine from Japan from like the 1930s or something. It's just cast iron. Like it probably weighs like 20 pounds. Like it's like maybe like this big, but you have to like really put your muscle into lifting onto the table. Yeah. You tried it, the atsuen on it is like freaking, you can smash anything in that thing and it just like makes it perfectly. And when I tried to compare it to like just the pasta machines that we have, it's like,
right. Yeah.
It makes me want to like try to get one from Japan, like one of those old school, like cast iron, because you can't do that with the Mercado Atlas. Like it just doesn't have the pressure to do that properly.
Yeah, the pressure is, that's one of the limiting factors of home.
Yeah.
Home noodle making. That's why
it's hard. And but like going back to it, like I feel like a lot of these shops that, you know, they serve a ramen or whatever at the shop, and they talk to Sun Noodle and like, just give me whatever you want. Sun Noodle can make some fantastic noodles, but if the chef is not being thoughtful and pairing their noodle properly, it's gonna make Sun Noodle look bad. Like, oh, Sun Noodles aren't that good. But like Sun Noodle can make they have the technology to make the best noodles. You know, some of the best noodles out there.
Insane factory over there. They have an insane facility. Really impressive, really.
So I just wish that like more of these shops that are just serving ramen would like be more thoughtful. Like, okay, I'm serving this style of ramen soup. I gotta pair it with this noodle because X, Y, and Z, rather than just like, hey, Sun Noodle, send me some noodles. I'm gonna sell it. You know, that's kind of one of my pet peeves anyway. Like, where it's like, anyways. A trap for fools asks, how would you? Well, I asked you that question already, so you don't have to answer that one. How would you incorporate innovation into the process? Deeply rooted in Czech traditions. Awesome Jenkins asks, how do I prevent my emotion from breaking? He's talking when he's making pythons. He's like, or how can I recognize early that it's gonna break?
Emotion?
Yeah, you know, like when you're making a python, sometimes like it'll split when you cool it and it's just like fat, and it's like the bottom is just basically like a chintan, like a clear chintan, and then the top is just like fat, you know?
Well, 20 python is not my specialty, because I've always been like a pork guy. It sounds cool. I mean, the easy way out is to just keep it a blend, right?
And then
that there's the content kind of stays emulsified. But yeah, 20 python is not my niche.
Okay. You gotta ask one of those tonkotsu guys. Yeah. All right. Yeah. So Ramen Nuts asks, what's the best way or best steps to achieve balance when you're making ramen?
Balance. A deep philosophical question.
Well, it's a good one because it's the last one, so I saved it for the end.
I think I mentioned this before, but I think you want the ramen to speak for itself, and you know, it's easy to make kind of rich soups with rich sauces, rich ingredients, rich toppings, overpowering flavors. You know, it's very common in the West here, and there's a huge demand for it, obviously. But as like a ramen fanatic, sometimes you find a lot more, you know, solace and kind of comfort in the simple things. You know, working with like the super simple tares, the broth that you just made that you know that's full of aromatic, complex flavors that really impact the flavor. Because yeah, like the aroma is a huge factor when it comes to tasting anything, right? So things like that, I think balancing those factors is gonna really up your experience. And I still obviously respect really rich soups and nothing against those, but if you're looking for balance, I think, you know, you find happiness, you know, in the simple things like shoyu ramen and really craft, work on that, you know, simple craft.
Yeah, I feel like there's just like less to hide behind when you're doing something like that. So it has to be, it almost like forces you to be more balanced when you're something like that. Yeah. Cool, man. That's basically all the questions I got. Do you want to add anything else before you want to talk about anything else before we go, or?
I don't know. I can rant all day.
I know that you prepped a lot of notes, it seems like. So, I mean, like anything that we missed or anything?
Oh, you know, I think we pretty much covered everything. There's one thing I missed. We use a really interesting water filter.
Yeah, that's all. I was gonna ask you about that, but I forgot to write the question down. Like I saw on your website, there's a specific link to it from your Gilpata website links to the website for that water. What is that?
It's called UG7.
Okay.
And it's got a patent for it, and essentially it's the only patented quantum water filter in the world right now. It's very fascinating. It's really fascinating. So essentially the water passes through the filter unit and it reorganizes and restructures the water molecules. And it's like super, I'm not a scientist, but it's really, really interesting. And
can you taste the difference? Like when you
Oh,
really?
I used to hate drinking water, but I drink nothing but water all day now because the water is so good here.
Interesting.
So it actually increases the level of dissolved hydrogen in the water. And why it's so important for cooking? Well, you don't taste any additives like fluoride or chlorine or anything in the water because it's nothing in there. Just tastes pure water. And because there's structure to the water, I believe that is it more absorbs the ingredients that you're cooking with better. So there's like a better give and take. So
I know in Japan, like there's a whole boom on like pie water or whatever you call. But it's something that I think a lot of people, and myself included, don't even think about much. I try to use like purified water when I make ramen, but I don't know what I'm doing. Like I know it will taste better than if I use the water from just the sink, but that's really interesting. I should check that out. But it's expensive, right? Like that machine is pretty expensive.
It is, yeah. So I was introduced to this when we opened Dumbo, and I didn't even know about this quantum water technology until it turns out Dumbo really prided themselves in using this really, really nice technology. And I used to go to a spring here in Vancouver because I was really obsessed with the delicious spring water there. Mm-hmm. And it has that kind of same feeling because spring water passes through multiple layers of rock.
Yeah.
Artesian spring water. So there's structure to that water as well, like on a molecular scale. Like, it's really fascinating. And so I believe there's the same thing going on with when you structure the water through the filter. it does the same thing. Pretty much makes spring water.
Interesting. Yeah, that's really cool.
Super fascinating. So I guess to make good soup, you gotta start with the good water.
That's definitely the most obvious thing, but also the least obvious thing, because it's because really at the end of the day, soup is like bones and water, right? Yeah. Bones and water and a little bit of other things, but water is like the main ingredient, basically.
And why?
All right, man. Tell everybody where they can find you online and your restaurant and stuff like that.
Yeah, Yo Fada, we're here in Vancouver, the Kitsilano area. Our Instagram name is Yo Fada, just one word. And you can find our website, yofada.com. I'm there every day. If you say hi, I'll hook you up. Some gyozas, And I love the community you have here. So shout out to everyone that's listening. I was really happy to be here. This was a great conversation. I love talking ramen. And we'll probably just continue talking right now. Keep going.
All right, man. Well, thanks so much. I'm going to close the recording here and we can keep talking for a little bit. I got to get going to a meeting, but we'll keep talking for a little bit. All right. Thanks, man. Thanks so much again to Alex for coming on the show. If you are in the BC area, please go check out Gyopara. I'll link up the website in the show notes. And you can also follow his Instagram account at Gyopara. As always, you can follow me on Instagram at Way of Ramen. Let me know what you guys think of the show or who you'd like to see on. Just tell me whatever you want to tell me. If you like this podcast, you can support it by becoming a supporter on Patreon at patreon.com/wayoframen. Thank you guys all so much for listening, and I'll see you all in the next episode. Peace.